It's one of the wonders of genetics that with more than 7 billion humans on Earth, no two are alike, identical twins notwithstanding, of course. Freelance computer programmer and modern art aficionado Ryan Schenk has captured that phenomenon in, of all things, Japanese paper lanterns. Ryan joins me this morning to talk about Breedlight and some of his other efforts to blend science and design.
Hi, Heather. Great to be here.
All right. You can join our conversation by calling 866-999-4626 or email us at livinglabradio@wgbh.org. Ryan, you first encountered modern art, or art history, I guess, in a formal sense, as a freshman in college in one of those diversification requirements that so many of us had to take in college. Were you surprised by how much you liked modern art?
Yes, I was. I took it, like you said, because I was forced to take it, or forced to choose to take it. But I ended up, we kind of did the intro to art history class, and we got to the modern period, and I just really, really enjoyed it. It was fun for me to see how different groups of people throughout time dealt with the exact same problem in completely different ways. And that I just ended up really falling in love with it, and I ended up taking a lot of art history throughout my college education.
But you chose not to major in it.
I didn't major in it. I took more than enough classes to minor in it, but I took them all in the modern period. And so due to some legal red tape at the school there, I was not able to get a minor. But yeah.
What was it about modern art in particular as compared to any of the other periods that really appealed to you?
I guess I liked it because, first, it was sort of relevant to us. We're not really in the modern era anymore, but it's still very relevant. And it was interesting to me because it's one of the more, in my opinion, self-conscious art movements. So it was trying to solve problems in art and in society in a very self-conscious and measured way that I think appealed to maybe the engineer in me a little bit.
What do you mean by solve problems? I mean, I usually think of art as being something aesthetically pleasing to appreciate, but not necessarily solving a problem.
Well, I guess one problem you can have, let's take painting, for example, you have a two-dimensional surface, yet we live as sort of four-dimensional beings. So we live in 3D space and we also live in time. So the cubists, to give a good example, were like the first people to try to tackle four dimensions at once in one painting. And they went about it, the paintings look crazy, but they went about it in a very self-conscious and measured way to try to capture this temporal existence inside of a 2D painting.
So let's talk about Breedlight. What was the problem you were trying to solve with Breedlight?
Well, as you mentioned, I work as a computer scientist, and at the time I was doing a lot of work with genes and genetics, real genes, real DNA. And I just had this idea. It wasn't really like a flash of inspiration, but I had this idea of like, what could we do? What could I do to take the idea of genes and turn that into some sort of piece of art or some sort of object? And it slowly developed over the course of about a year or so that I was thinking about it. I knew I wanted to make something that would go into people's houses. I wanted something that would be there to see every day that you could look at, you could touch, you could feel, and you could also sort of, it was almost like an organism. It had this underlying life force almost.
So why lanterns? Why these Japanese paper lanterns?
Well, I wanted it to be a household object because I wanted it to be, I don't know, almost like a pet, like something you'd see every day. So it had to be some sort of household design object, but, you know, clearly you can't, if you have a chair, you have to sit in it. If you have a table, it can't fall over. So lamps are like, their shape is a little bit divorced from their function. You can make a crazy looking lamp and it will still light up. So that's how I sort of arrived on lamps. Plus they're kind of magical. Like you turn them on, they make light. It's really cool.
So these lamps, I mean, when I was first looking at pictures of Breedlight, I have to admit that one of the first associations for me, I said, oh, these look kind of like the IKEA lanterns. Perhaps people have seen those. I mean, they're these beautiful different shapes, but it's essentially just a very large Japanese paper lantern, a wood frame with with paper stretched around it. And in fact, if you'd like to see pictures of some of these, you can actually go to our website, go to capeandislands.org, click on Living Lab, and we've got some pictures of Ryan's Breedlight lamps. I mean, you told me the other day that this was not the first time that someone had played with these Japanese paper lanterns, that in fact the IKEA ones are popular now, but that this is a form that people have been playing with for a while.
Yeah, that's right. I think the first, it is a traditional Japanese craft, I guess you could call it. And I think the first person to sort of take that traditional craft and then bring it into sort of a modern design context was this designer named Noguchi. He did this, I think, in around the 50s. He was a Japanese-American, and he took traditional Japanese lanterns. They're called chojins. I probably murdered the pronunciation. But he took them and turned them into design pieces and kind of like what I did. It's a traditional lamp. It's paper. It's on a wood frame. But the size and shape sort of express kind of a fundamental designer artiness. And what he was really going for is, to that time, the lanterns were had flame inside of them. He wanted to use the paper and the wood and this organic shape to sort of humanize electric light almost. So it gets the electric light kind of comes out of this harsh little bulb. It gets filtered through the paper, and the light almost becomes natural. And he started doing this, and then another American designer, George Nelson, sort of took a similar riff. He made his a little more industrially out of metal and sort of this weird fiberglass stuff. And then IKEA kind of came along and figured out a way to produce them for the masses in a way that everybody can afford.
So what's really unique about your lamps or lanterns is the fact that that each one is unique. And they're designed by the computer. You give it essentially a mother and a father lamp. The typical example would be you start with a short, fat lamp, one that's very round, very spherical, and a tall, skinny one that's basically just a column, and you breed them.
That's right.
And what you might expect to happen is that you get the same thing every time, you know, one that's somewhere in between in height with a little bit of a bulb in the middle or something, you know. But instead, you get something different every time.
Almost every time, yeah. That's right.
How do you make a computer do that? Can you tell us a little bit about what's actually going on in the programming to recreate this phenomenon?
Yeah, it's modeled very closely on real DNA. So there are about 20 genes in this sort of abstract DNA that I made, and each gene controls a specific portion of the lamp's size or shape or height or width, that kind of thing. And there are different variants on that gene. So a good human example is your eye color. You know, you have one gene for eye color, not really, but you get brown, blue, green eyes, hazel eyes, all those variants of that same trait. And so I started with, like you mentioned, I started with kind of two extremes. I wanted to make a globe-shaped lamp. I wanted to make sort of a cylindrical lamp. And then I wanted to be able to make basically any shape in between the two of them. So I started sketching out different frameworks where I could almost mathematically turn on and off portions of this framework to make different shapes. And the reason why each, you know, the reason why each child of a parent lamp is unique is because they do have a little bit of a chromosome, and they do have two alleles, one from their mommy lamp and one from their daddy lamp. And those two alleles interact and get expressed in different ways, kind of like in our cells.
So, I mean, but somehow there's a randomization process there, right? You're not just getting the same average every time.
That's true. That's true. So there's one chromosome, two alleles per gene. And yes, I randomly assort them. I think that's the proper biological term. So, every single time a lamp is bred from two parents, it looks at the parents' two chromosomes, so to speak, splits them randomly, and then combines the two random halves. And so you get quite a bit of variation between two parents, you know, over multiple children.
Yeah, I mean, some of the shapes that'll come out of this just cross between a sphere and a cylinder, sometimes almost like a figure eight, and sometimes a little bit of a bulb at the top. How hard is it to make all of these different... You're making these by hand,
I'm making them by hand. It's a hard balance to strike because you want the children lamp to look like their parents, but you don't want it... You do want some variation, so it's a tough balance to strike. And that's sort of what I strove for in the DNA. I tweaked the genes to allow me to do that. But in terms of physically constructing them, yeah, I have a computer that generates, at the moment, full-size drawings of what I need to make. And then I hand make jigs to build the lamps on. And then I make those out of thin plywood. And then I do it the traditional Japanese way of wrapping this caning around and then gluing sheets of paper and cutting them to size.
Is that something you knew how to do beforehand or you learned just...
I had no idea how to do it. I knew I wanted to make these things, and that construction technique was... I don't have a lot of money. That was kind of the cheapest and the most accessible way for me to do it. So I learned how after I had already designed the lamps. So I knew vaguely what I wanted them to look like, and then I figured out how to make them physically.
I mean, there's this neat parallel. Obviously, you're basing the whole idea on the biology of genetics, but there's also this neat parallel in that what you're creating is almost a skeleton with a skin over it. Is almost... a parallel to biology in that sense.
Yes, exactly. And that's always the trick when you're making sculptures, is you want the physical object to fully realize the concept. So you're exactly right. It is a skeleton with a skin on it, because I wanted these little things to be, have that sort of structure, to be like an organism, to have, you know, an internal structure in a cell membrane, if you want to look at it that way, or, you know, a skeleton with a skin stretched on top of it. Exactly.
So this is, you said you chose the wood and paper in part because that's a fairly low cost and you can do it all by hand yourself. Is there any way, though, of, with something so labor intensive, of scaling this up and making it a more widely available product, I guess?
It is possible. Because the shapes are bred inside the computer sort of creates the paths, the profiles of the thing. And it would be possible to feed those shapes into either a computer-controlled cutting machine, like a laser cutter, or even a 3D printer that could take this abstract 3D object that's in the computer and then generate it out of some sort of plastic-type material. And that's exactly what you'd need to do to make these at a wider scale. And I think that construction technique would sort of better express what's going on with these sculptures rather than this traditional one that I had chosen at the time.
Why is that?
I guess it's kind of, I don't know, I'm kind of lying when I make these beautiful traditional lanterns from this very computer-based algorithmic type of blueprint, so to speak. I think, you know, in sculpture, you're always trying to express your concept as accurately as possible in the physical product and like truly realize the thing you're trying to say. And because these are computer generated, you would really want the physical construction to also, in my opinion, have some sort of computer input, computer control to it.
In terms of someone having one of these in their home, chances are that most people aren't going to have an entire family of breed lights in their living room. That might be, you know, an installation at a gallery, perhaps.
Speak for yourself.
How many do you have in your living room?
At the moment, I've got three. They're a nice little family.
I guess I'm wondering, in terms of following this concept through, does it become in any way apparent to a casual observer, or is this something that to really appreciate it, you have to be part of the process of creating it?
I think so. The DNA is embedded into the physical lamp through a QR code. I don't know if you've seen those before. They're sort of about an inch square, look like a checkerboard. You can read them with your smartphone. So I do have a smartphone app that runs on the iPhone that you can take a picture of a breed light's DNA through this code. So you can walk up to a physical lamp, launch my app, take a picture of it, and it will read the DNA out and give you this interface that you can look at the lamp, look at its parents, breed it with another one, that sort of stuff. So I think in order to buy these things, it's not just a lamp. You're sort of, it's almost like a kennel club. You know, you're buying a little pet, a little art pet.
So, I mean, what you're talking about is such a mishmash of the art history that you've learned and obviously incorporated, and your computer science background, and also the biology. In your mind, is what you're doing, is it science? Is it art? Is it both? What is this when you're thinking about it?
I think of Breedlight as a concept, as a different entity than Breedlight, the physical lamp. And I think Breedlight as a project, yes, it is a biological based art project. So I am using a computer, I'm using biology, I'm using programming, but they are all means to achieve an art project. I'm not saying anything other than making these shapes that I think are beautiful. As for the individual lamps themselves, I think that definition gets a little bit fuzzy. I don't think at the moment the lamps themselves are necessarily art pieces. I think they're design objects, but I think they're still objects. You know, I don't really think of them as art pieces in and of themselves, but they are one component in this broader big art project, which is Breedlight, which is using biology to make these reproducing lamps.
So what for you is the distinction between art and design?
I think a piece of art needs to do three things. A good sculpture needs to do three things. It needs to transform its materials. So it's not just paper and bamboo. It's now this great shape. It needs to say something inherent about itself, which I think the lamps do. They're in and of themselves, even if you didn't know the sort of genetic background, they are beautiful looking lamps. I also think a good piece of art needs to be self-conscious about its artistic status and about sort of where it falls in the continuum of art. Maybe this is my art history background coming out, but it needs to be self-conscious of the statement it's making, not only of its own accord, but also what it's saying about art.
Well, a listener has asked, what other media do you work in? And this, of course, is not your first foray into combining computers and art. So tell us about some of your other projects.
That's true. Well, anyone who's a Woods Holer probably saw an installation that my wife and I did at Coffee Obsession a few years ago, where we made lots and lots of mobiles that were looked like crows. We pretty much covered Coffee at Woods Hole with those, and that was really fun. That was a collaboration between my wife, Ruth Bleakley, and I. I guess my medium, I think, turns out to be hanging things from the ceiling. So I've got these lamps, they hang from the ceiling. I've got mobiles, they hang from the ceiling. I have built... the first big sculpture I did was my senior thesis, and it was a grid of 36 spheres hanging from the ceiling. And each one of those spheres, unbeknownst to the viewer, was hooked up to an electric motor. All the motors were tied into a computer, and then there was a camera watching the whole scene. And the computer would sit there and watch what was happening underneath the sculpture. It would detect people moving around under the sculpture and then would raise the spheres directly above them, sort of almost to visualize the column of air that a viewer was displacing, so to speak. And as you moved and walked under the sculpture, these balls would ripple and jiggle as they follow you around.
That wasn't, as you explained it to me, that wasn't the full, I guess, motivation. It wasn't just the beauty of the rippling, though. That was intended to make a statement about the interactiveness of art as
well.
It
sure was. So... going back to the three things, I guess, what it says about art is, back in the 60s, there was an art movement called minimalism, and these sculptors were making these pieces like, you know, steel boxes. Richard Serra was taking two giant pieces of metal and leaning them together. Dan Flavin was exhibiting fluorescent light bulbs. There were these pieces of art that were so spare and so Spartan. One art critic could only figure it out by thinking, you know, these pieces of the steel box only becomes art when you stick it into a gallery. And the kind of natural extension to that was, well, this is a little more like theater than sculpture, because there's sort of this actor, the sculpture. It needs to be in a venue the gallery or the stage, and then it needs someone to look at it. It needs an audience. So it's not really a sculpture. It's like the actual art is the process of viewing the sculpture as an observer. So really it's this interaction between the viewer and the sculpture that is the art. And because he was a modernist, he thought this was a bad thing. He thought sculpture should be about sculpture, theater should be about theater, and the two should not mix. So I took this notion of this interaction being the art, and I built a sculpture that was literally interactive. So it looks like a minimalist sculpture, but it responds to the viewers. It's literally interactive. And then kind of, I don't know.
So what else have you hung from the ceiling?
A few years ago at TEDx, I built this sculpture. It was a giant piece of silk, also hanging from the ceiling. And it was also electrified, hooked up to a computer. And the giant piece of silk would draw graphs of scientific data. So instead of, if you have a trend, you can put in a PowerPoint like a line graph, or you could send it to my sculpture and it would draw the same line graph shape, but in a big piece of silk hanging in front of you. And you could walk up to it, you could touch your data, you could sit under your data, you could have a conversation through your data. And that was the idea, was to try to bring scientific data out of computer land and into a little more tangible land, to turn it into an experience rather than just something that you look at on a screen.
So you obviously think that not only art but also science should both be very interactive processes, not something that sits there separately from people, but something that anyone could really engage in.
I think so. I mean, in terms of that sculpture, I sacrificed a bit of precision for this interaction. It's awfully hard to make accurate guesses about a piece of silk, but you can see the broader trends, and that was the idea, was to get the big picture out there and make it something. We literally had a cocktail party underneath scientific data. We had literally millions of data points hanging from the ceiling, and people were talking about it. They were touching it. They were blowing on it. They were. We had a great time.
I mean, how do you actually get, was the silk hanging from a whole bunch of different strings? How did you get, you know, like a curve or?
Exactly. Yeah. The silk was about 25 feet long, give or take. And it was hung from a whole bunch of little tiny threads. And each one of those threads was hooked up to a little pulley and a little electric motor. And they were all wired into a computer. And so the computer knew about the data you were feeding it, and then figured out how to make the silk move into the correct shape. And then I had a projector shining through the silk that could put metadata on top of it. So you could have, you know, labels, you could pick out historic events, you could do all kinds of stuff with the projector. So, and that was another idea, was what if we could take this metadata, which is something I work a lot with, and express it literally through the data, you know. Metadata is this thing that it sort of sits on top of your data. Why not take that literally? Why not literally blast it through the data?
So what kinds of, I mean, give me an example of what's the metadata to go with what kind of data?
One thing that I showed on it was a graph of a higher order taxa, like a grouping of animals. And how many new species in that grouping of animals was discovered per year. One of the more interesting ones was whales, cetacea. You could see a huge trend in the number of new whales being discovered in the mid to late 1800s. I assume that's from the whaling industry. Another good one was octopuses. I guess there were two big monographs that described a ton of new octopus species. I forget the exact dates, but one came out around the late 1800s and another one came out in 1930, thereabouts. And you could see those two huge spikes in these graphs. It was very fun. And so we would, I would project the name of the taxa going through the cloth and historic events and that sort of stuff with the projector.
Do you think the kinds of interactions and even these projects that you're coming up with would be possible any place, or is this just something so special about Woods Hole where you have such a creative community right in and amongst cheek by jowl with so many scientists?
I do think, at least in terms of the scientific data graphing sculpture, I think that's pretty uniquely Woods Hole. I think it takes a high degree of scientific literacy to figure out what was going on in that sculpture. And we showed it at TEDx Woods Hole, I think the 2010 one. And I think that one is very uniquely Woods Hole. Some of the other pieces, I do think you can still get something out of it, even if you don't understand biology. You can take two lamps and mate them together and see the children. You can appreciate that even if you don't quite know the science behind it.
So do you have any plans to make Breedlight commercially available, or is this just going to be a hobby for yourself for the foreseeable future?
Each lamp takes me about a day and a half to make at the moment, so I'd go crazy if I was making these for a commercial. I got too many other things to do to be making lamps all day. But given the opportunity with some computer-controlled cutting machines and that sort of stuff in a new way to build these, yeah, I could see making them, turning them into products. It'd be great to have other people, not just me, with this project in their house. I would love that.
Do you think it would benefit the concept in any way, having other people involved in the production?
Oh, yeah, I think it'd be great. I think producing a lamp is as easy as taking two lamps that you like and then, you know, seeing what sort of babies they come up with. And I think you'd almost have natural selection at that point, because if it was a commercial product, the lamps that sold the most would reflect the design tastes of the folks buying them. So you really would have sort of an evolution by natural selection, so to speak, where the most successful passers on of their genetic information would be the lamps that perhaps, people liked the most.
Ryan Schenk is a freelance computer programmer and the creator of Breedlight. Thanks for being here, Ryan.
Thanks, Heather.
You can find a link to the Breedlight website on our website. Go to capeandislands.org and click on Living Lab. This is Living Lab on The Point. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab on The Point is produced by Heather Goldstone. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Dan Treidel and Jenny Junker. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter. Living Lab on the Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.